This is Thoughts on the Table by DisgracesOnTheMenu.com.
Hello and welcome to Thoughts on the Table, the audio blog. My guest today is Raffaella De Amicis. I've been knowing Raffaella for quite some time through the social networks. We follow each other on Twitter, and I discovered that we share the same passion for authentic Italian food. And Raffaella also happens to be a talented photographer. And obviously, this is very interesting to me as a food blogger, because, of course, food photography really matters in food blogs. So with me today is Raffaella. Good morning, Raffaella. How are you?
Good morning. I'm good.
Fantastic. Thanks so much for connecting with me. So when I asked Raffaella to send me a brief bio to prepare for this podcast, I kind of put her on the spot a little bit. And she said, well, I am an Italy-obsessed creative who landed on photography as her preferred form of expression. Now, of course, I know the answers, but I'm going to ask Raffaella, since I have her here in person, to tell me where this obsession for Italy came from, and also how did you land on photography?
I don't know which came first, if it was the chicken or the egg, but I think probably the photography a little bit came first. My mother was an art teacher for a long time, and so she would teach us, you know, watercolors and pastels, but also a little bit of photography. This was long before digital was even a logical option for anybody, so you kind of had to learn the basics and wait to get the feedback until you got the film. And I just found that I really enjoyed the photography. It just was the medium that spoke to me. And then the obsession with Italy honestly kind of came a little bit more as an adult. Of course, I always enjoyed it. We went for the first time that I can remember. When I was 11, we went for a whole month, and of course, it was amazing. We started in Switzerland and made our way down to Grottaglie, where my father is from.
Oh, okay.
And that was definitely my first taste of travel abroad. And then just as the years have gone by, you know, between the food and the scenery and the people, it's just kind of grown and grown and grown. And I have, of course, a personal attachment to it, you know, being that that's where my father is from. You know, and I always kind of mean to visit other places, and I want to visit other places, but I can't help myself if my only option is I have to pick one. I will almost always pick Italy because there's so much more and I can't get enough of it.
Have you visited other parts of Italy?
The other parts that I've visited, I've been to Florence a few times, Rome a few times, Venice only once, but I really want to go back. But I also just kind of want to go to, like, Sardinia is just, I just want to go. I want to spend like a month there. You know, I haven't had a whole lot of opportunity to spend time up north, but, you know, Turin and Milan, and of course all the, you know, countryside in between and the amazing parks and the mountains and the beaches. I mean, there's just, it's just mind boggling the sheer variety, you know, small towns, big cities, the different kinds of landscapes, and of course the unique foods that go with those. So between all that, you know, my camera and my belly are very happy and very excited every time I get a chance.
Speaking about belly, we should mention that your dad worked as a chef. So he's a chef. And this also has something to do with your passion for Italian food. He has been obviously cooking for you as well.
Yes.
And so this taught you, I suppose, to love authentic, simple Italian flavors.
Definitely. I mean, you know, he comes from the Puglia region, which is sort of that cucina povera that is a lot of that's what made it over here. Of course, you know, so many of the Italians that emigrated here many, many years ago were mostly from southern Italy. So they kind of brought that food over. And, you know, we were good, but we, you know, we weren't rich growing up. So it was nice because then you got to have these amazing meals that weren't expensive. For a while, I think maybe it was a little difficult to get some of the authenticity of certain ingredients because growing up in Florida and South Carolina, for the most part, you know, the grocery stores, they didn't carry pancetta. They didn't know what pancetta was. You know, the cheese, if you could get real Parmesan, it was very, very expensive. So you had to settle for Kraft. But once everybody kind of caught up and we moved to New York, that was amazing because we
easier.
Able to get those things and really, you know, kind of, and we just kind of learned as we grew up, you know, dad would cook and we'd participate and we'd learn about how to do things. And so it was a very natural education and progression and appreciation of the food.
So do you cook as well?
I do. I would never do it professionally because I'm too slow. and I think it would take all the fun out of it for me.
Yeah, yeah, no, I know what you mean. I cook, but I cook for two. Cooking for four is already yeah. big.
I think the most
problem.
I've cooked for is about six for a real full dinner. I actually did braised lamb shanks, and I was very proud of myself. It was the first time I'd ever done it.
So since we're talking about your cooking, what's your signature dish, if you were to define it?
I would say, honestly, probably pasta carbonara. Mm. You know, that was always a treat when we were kids. And then I kind of actually started running with it. I had gone to Rome not that long ago. I guess it was only about 6 or 7 years ago. And I went to a little restaurant. I can't remember the name. I have to find it. I have it saved somewhere on my computer. And it really was the best carbonara I ever had. You know, it was that golden yellow color, and it was made with real guanciale, which is very hard to find here still. So most of the time you'll use pancetta. And so that's just, it's simple, and it always impresses, and it's a little bit challenging because you have to time everything just right. So there's a little bit of drama that goes with the making of it. So
The egg
it's
has to
definitely
be,
worth the reward.
Exactly. The egg has to be just right. Not too...
not too hot, not too cool. Just right. It's like the Goldilocks of Italian dishes, I think.
I know. I mean, I grew up in the north, so pancetta was actually used. And I remember as well from my trip to Rome when I still ate meat. Now I only eat fish. And that was something else. Something else.
It was a food revelation.
Yes, it was.
Honestly.
So you have to do that. You have to go exactly where the dish is from to really appreciate what it's supposed to be. So, Raffaella, you offered to talk to us about food photography and photography in general. Thanks so much. I'm sure there's a lot of people who would enjoy your tips, your suggestions. I would start with some photography basics, which is something that you rarely hear about because I guess people take it for granted. But once you put that aside, as you mentioned in your email, things get a lot easier once you start to get your ideas around it. So do you want to start? I know it's a broad topic, but I'm sure you can.
It is a broad topic. And some of it's a little bit more challenging to do just by talking because it is such a visual medium and teaching it with visual representations really helps a lot. But, you know, the key thing, and this goes back to what I learned, because, again, this was before everything was so advanced and did a lot of the work for you and you didn't have to worry about it. But, you know, you have aperture, which is how much light is allowed in through the lens. So you can have a very small aperture, which will actually be a big number. So it'll be it's designated by the term f-stop. So you have an f-16, which is a very small aperture. It doesn't let in very much light. And then you have a large aperture, which will be a small number. It's a little bit of a counterintuitive. And that might be something as small as, say, f1.2. You know, that's almost sort of the critical thing because it affects not only how much light is coming in, but it also affects your depth of field, which is how much of your image is in focus. And that's an important choice in composition in general, but particularly in food photography and sort of what you're trying to achieve. And then the way that all works together with your ISO, which is how sensitive your film is, if you will. You know, back in the day, you had to pick one and stick with it until you finished the roll of film. Now you can change it to suit the situation, which is really nice. And so something, a smaller number like ISO 200 is not very sensitive, but it generally gives, working in broad strokes, a better quality image. You don't have that graininess or what's called noise to it. And then you also have your shutter speed, which is how fast the shutter opens, and that works with the aperture. And the biggest thing with shutter speed is, of course, whether you're trying to introduce or eliminate motion in the image, which can cause blur. And again, it all depends on what you're trying to achieve. Sometimes you do want some motion in the image, but generally, of course, with food photography, you don't want that because you want to be able to see the food. Any blur should be from the depth of field, whether you have a lot or a little bit.
Right.
So those are kind of the basics. You know, if you Google exposure triangle, that'll really, you can find some nice charts and in-depth information about how those all work together so you can make those decisions. And now with modern cameras, you know, there's so many options and so much technology behind it that it kind of takes a lot of the guesswork out, which is great because, you know, if you're just doing it casually, you don't want to have to go get a degree in photography to take a nice picture. But it is important to understand how these things work and also how your camera works. So mm-hmm. my other big piece of advice is always read your manual, please. So many people don't read it. And most manuals are pretty good. And they'll go over a lot of those basics about aperture and shutter speed. Mm-hmm. And of course, where you can find all those adjustments on there. You know, so many people shoot with iPhones now and don't, or smartphones, I should say. I say iPhone because that's what I have. But, you know, and those aren't always as flexible in terms of letting you make choices about what you want it to look like.
Right. Mm-hmm, of course. So when you get a camera, yeah, I know. Myself, I often end up leaving it on auto on my digital SLR because I guess my use is more like documentary and I really just care to bring home something. But I do appreciate... I'm an engineer. I like these things.
Yeah.
And I like to experiment between, I don't know, priority of speed as opposed to priority of aperture and see where I can push my camera, in which direction. So if I want to favor a very steady shot or if I have a lot of light or a tripod and I want to favor a narrow aperture to get a lot of depth of field. Sometimes you want just the opposite, exactly, because a narrow depth of field can do magic to your composition in some cases.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think sometimes, you know, it's about just what you're trying to achieve and how much time and patience you have. You know, if it's just not your particularly in-depth hobby, like, you know, it's great that the technology kind of allows you to let it sort of take the reins. It's sort of like, you know, autopilot a little bit.
Sometimes.
But you want to be able to steer when you want to as well. Mm-hmm. And again, when you understand how these things work from the technical perspective, it allows you to solve problems. Why is my image too dark? Why is it blurry? Why, you know, why am I not getting what I'm trying to do? Because the camera is a machine and it has algorithms and all that technical programming stuff. But in the end, it doesn't know what you're trying to do.
Exactly. And it doesn't see like your eye.
No, not at all. Our eyes are incredible.
That's the thing. So you said, you know, it depends what you're trying to do. And so purpose, of course, is very important. Once you identify that, it's it makes it easier. What about food photography, which I know is something that people listening will wonder about? Do you have your own magic rules or, you know?
Not necessarily. I mean, you know, again, it's all about what you're trying to achieve. A little bit of your own personal taste and a little bit of experimentation, you know, and what suits the food. If you're trying to instruct and you're wanting to take pictures of the different steps in cooking, you're not going to want a lot of shadow. You'll want, you know, good broad light so that people can see what you're doing. And you may be wanting to freeze motion or something like that, depending, you know, if it's a picture of whisking something. You may not want that, or you may want to have that motion visible, so you'll use a little bit slower shutter speed so you can see the movement of the whisk a little bit. If you're more doing something, you know, I do a lot of shooting for restaurants, small restaurants, which is where you're trying to make people look at that picture and go, oh, I want to eat that. So you don't want them to wonder what it is. So you do want it to look very appealing. You don't want it to look clinical, but you want there to be enough light so that they can, again, identify it. You want it to look juicy or crispy or spicy, hot. You know, there's so many different adjectives that you can use that you're trying to communicate. Sort of a good across-the-board type of lighting is what's often called side or back lighting, and that's very commonly used in food. And it can be just a big window that you're sitting next to. The important thing is that the light is soft. So a small light bulb isn't really going to give you that. It's going to be very hard light, and then you're going to have to start adding other light in order to see what you want to see of the food. But the lighting is the most important thing in photography. Without light, you don't have anything. You know, there are a lot of things you can fix with composition or, you know, a little bit of motion blur, a little bit. But if you have bad lighting, there's not a whole lot of ways around it. I mean, yes, if you want to spend hours in Photoshop, you can probably do a fair amount. But no, but most people don't want to spend hours in Photoshop. So it's much easier to understand it and do it correctly when you take the picture. And then, you know, anything you do might be a small tweak for sharpness or saturation or something like that. So if you have side or back lighting, you know, you want a big light source, a big window. If you are using a flash, if that's something you're using, you'll want to do what's called diffusing it, which is where there's something in front of it, an umbrella, something translucent and white that you're shooting through it. And then you also have to consider the what's called color temperature. Right. Daylight is going to be a very cool light, whereas mm-hmm. if you're in, a restaurant or even in your home, most of your lights are going to be a warm light. So you have that sort of bluish versus orangish. So if you can try and keep the color temperatures the same or similar, that's more ideal, because then you're going to have some weird effects from that if you don't.
Right. I remember trying to go close to a window, which is mm-hmm. what I normally do when I try to take pictures of my plate. But the light outside wasn't enough, so I had also turn on my incandescent lights in mm-hmm. in the place, and I thought it was okay. It gave me some interesting result, which I didn't mind. Mm-hmm. But then, you know, the end result was terrible, and there was no, of course, white compensation that I could have operated digitally. You're fighting between, you know, trying to get the white from the external light source white, or the white from your incandescent light white. Mm-hmm. And you end up with a picture which is either blue or red, and there's really no way to fix it. Mm-hmm. So I really like your suggestion, actually. This is my takeaway. You have to match lighting, then you can do something about it. What if you're shooting with flash? Do you ever use flash?
I do. And flash is nice if you are mixing it with daylight, because they're the same color. Mm-hmm. Now, if you're working with flash and what's called an incandescent light, so that's a yellow or orangish light, mm-hmm. Then you have to start doing what's called gelling the flash, where you put a little, you know, sort of clear piece, and it's kind of orange colored, and it makes that flash the same color as the incandescent light. And there are different levels. Some are just a little bit orange, others mm-hmm. are stronger. It just depends on the lighting you're working with. And again, that's where you start getting into a more advanced level, and you're carrying around more stuff.
Right.
And, you know, most of the times you're not going to go on vacation or go out to eat and carry gels and flashes and, you know, all that crazy stuff. So sometimes the best thing to do is, you know, either try and keep the incandescent light from falling on the food. Because if the background's orange, it doesn't really matter.
Okay.
So if you're next to a window, say, and there's an overhead light, but the window light's really good, sometimes if you're exposing correctly for the light coming from the window, mm-hmm. that incandescent light is very weak and it won't actually register. But generally speaking, you can also just block it. You know, if you just keep a little piece of like white card or one of those mm-hmm. little like 12-inch collapsible reflectors in there, you can use that either to block light, because sometimes mm-hmm. it's about subtracting light, or you can also use it for fill light, where if you have, if you're facing the dish and the window's on the left, so you're getting that nice side or a little bit of backlighting, you basically would place that white card on the opposite side of it. It throws a little bit of light back onto the dish, so mm-hmm. the shadows aren't as hard, nice. And you can see a little bit more. And it's easier to get broader exposure. I hesitate using the word correct for exposure, because that's a little bit subjective. Mm-hmm. It's about what's correct for what you're trying to achieve.
Yeah.
And that goes, you know, if you are just trying to look at the food, but you want a little bit of ambiance in the background, you do want to be able to see what's in the background, even if right. it's just indistinct and out of focus. But if you don't really care about that, well, then the correct exposure is whatever makes the food look good, even if the background is all white or all black.
Do you think food styling is important as well as the use of props?
Yes. I do think that matters, because it sort of gives it a sense of place, a little personality. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's kind of like having a model. You want the model to look their best. Mm-hmm. You don't want stray hairs and smudged makeup and, you know, wrinkled clothes. And again, it's going back to simplicity. You know, there's kind of an old saying, well, I don't know how old, but, you know, there's a saying called KISS, keep it simple, stupid. I hate using the last S, but so I just use KIS, keep it simple. The more elements you introduce, the more difficult you make it, the more experience you kind of need to make all those extra things work together. Mm-hmm. So if you're shooting a dish, you know, it's just little things, little detail things, like making sure that the edge of the plate is clean. Mm-hmm. It might be as simple as kind of turning it and, you know, moving a little piece of lettuce here, or, you know, adding an extra sprinkle of cheese just in the front. Mm-hmm. You kind of get a feel for that, so that, you know, you can see the shapes and the textures and the colors coming through on the food. Mm-hmm. And then you might introduce something like a glass of wine in the background that, you know, people can kind of see, but again, it's probably going to be out of focus.
Right.
It just depends on what you're trying to communicate, because mm-hmm. that's also what photography is. It's, you're literally painting with light, because if there's absolutely no light, there's no picture.
Correct.
Of course, there's always some kind of light. But but on top of that, it's a way of communicating. Mm-hmm. And you can communicate so many different things. You know, I mean, it's not just, you know, with food, generally speaking, you want to communicate this is something that you want to eat. That's usually the goal with food photography.
Make it appetizing, obviously.
Exactly.
Which is the hardest thing, really. Mm-hmm. It was for me. I fought with that a lot initially. I was always very pleased with my dish, but the picture would not come any close to describing how good it tasted. And then, you know, with practice, I think I've improved a little bit. And I'm continuing to improve. So I really appreciate your tips here.
Of course.
What about composition? Say you want maybe something in the background, but as I understand, the star of the food photography picture is the dish itself. What is your take there on angles and framing?
Again, it comes back to keeping it simple. You know, if you start getting in crazy, you know, crooked angles and stuff like that before you really understand using those to achieve something rather than just doing it for the sake of doing it, I think you're not going to get typically a good result. I mean, sometimes you get lucky and, you know, there's nothing wrong with experimenting.
Right.
You know, so you have your angle of view, which is whether you're looking at the dish from straight overhead, from the front, from the side, you know, or somewhere in there. There's a little bit of a trend I've kind of seen, not in fairly recently, where there's a lot of people doing it from straight above. And it's very almost kind of graphic and technical looking, which, again, that's a style. And sometimes it works and sometimes, you know, somebody might not like it. And then you have the stuff that's a little bit more traditional. But understanding composition in general will really help. The most common tool is what's called the rule of thirds. So you're looking at your camera, you know, and it's a rectangle. And so you have two lines across and two lines the other direction. Mm-hmm. So you basically wind up with nine little rectangles.
And some cameras have that in one of your
Some will actually
presets.
Overlay that, yeah, which is really handy, especially before you get used to that and kind of learn to see it for yourself. I find it distracting sometimes because you also have to think about if you're going to crop the image later. And so there are a lot of factors that come in. But, you know, while you're learning, it's an incredibly helpful tool. And that's not to say you can never break the rule either. But if you're breaking a rule, you need to decide why you're doing it, not, I just don't want to follow the rules. if you're going to be a rebel, do it right. So your subject of interest, your focal point, whether it's the icing on the cake or, you know, the steam coming off the tortellini or, I mean, there's so many different things you can choose to make your focal point. Typically, that's going to fall either within one of those nine rectangles or at the intersection of those lines is where you kind of want it to lead to. And then you also have what's called leading lines, where if the easiest example is if you look at a picture of a road, well, your eye is going to follow that line.
Okay.
And you can do that with color or shape. You can do it with light or dark. The human eye is naturally drawn to light, as in, you know, like white, or to bright color. So if you've got bright colors somewhere else in the image, but you're taking a picture of a steak, you kind of don't necessarily want that because your eye's going to go to what's bright.
Yes.
So that's another thing that people can look for is understanding the rule of thirds and understanding leading lines and how that brightness of color or dramaticness of color and lightness of tone in an image kind of draw your eye. And you can use it to tell the viewer where to look. And that's for photography in general, but it applies in food as well. As far as having props, again, that's more about setting an atmosphere. You might choose to use a very rustic plate if you're doing a traditionally rustic dish, or if you're doing sort of something very modern and, you know, something like that, you might stick to a more simple plating.
So the plate itself is
a prop. The plate itself matters. I hate shooting on white plates. It's my least favorite. They're boring and annoying and distracting, and that's where the eye tends to go, and I hate them. But that's a personal thing.
Well,
because so many restaurants use white plates. Almost all restaurants use white plates. So that's a lot of time, too, where you get into the food styling, actually coming back around to that. You'll get into maybe sauces and garnishes, kind of almost camouflaging or reducing how dominant that white is. And that's also where framing comes into play. I'll sometimes do something called cheating the plate, which is where you can't really get a good angle on it. So as long as there's not anything too liquid on the plate, what I'll do is I'll use anything. I've used lens caps, I've used folded up towels, whatever, and I'll prop up the back or one edge of the plate so that it cheats it. And, you know, you only do it slightly, otherwise it looks weird. But it can really just kind of take you from, ugh, just not getting what I want, to, aha, now it's in the right position.
Okay, so you're lifting the back of the plate to face it towards the camera.
And it just angles the food a little bit better so you can still get that overall angle that you want because you've set up a particular background or you like the way the out-of-focus background looks. So, because if you were to change your camera angle to match the food, well, then you lose that background that you like. So it kind of lets you have your cake and eat it too, so to speak.
Fantastic. Oh, this is a fantastic tip. Because I do have that problem. When I want something in my background, even just a glass of wine, I never can frame it because, you know, if I look at my plate, my glass of wine is going to be cut off and vice versa. Or my plate won't be the star anymore. And there's too much around that glass of wine. So, yeah, it's a fantastic tip. I'm going to try.
Helps.
I do have white plates. I photograph my own food mostly, and you're right, white is difficult, but I think color or a pattern would be really hard as well.
It can be too. It introduces its own set of issues, but again, it, you know, you can find either a subtle pattern. It doesn't have to be a brightly colored plate, and it may not always necessarily be about that. You know, another thing that I see in a lot of restaurants that's kind of a style trend is dark tables. So then you have a white plate on a dark table, and it just makes life harder. You know, and you work around it because that's what they have. But you know, you can use pieces of fabric to, you know, look like a tablecloth. So you might put, you might say, okay, I have a white plate. Well, let me put a gray or a beige or a light blue, whatever happens to work, piece of cloth under it. So the plate's not as garish. You don't have that dark table and then the white plate. Or if you're using a pattern plate, you can use a soft color under it that coordinates with it, but then you don't have that pattern plate standing out quite as much. And it's also, you know, about what particular food you're shooting. There's so many different factors that go into it. If you have a million colors and a million patterns happening, then you're not going to be able to tell the viewer where to look because their eye's going to be jumping all over the picture. So that kind of goes back to keeping it simple, silly, not stupid, silly, where, you know, more simplicity, it makes your life easier. You're not going back later and going, oh, I shouldn't have done that. And then there's not really anything you can do about it. You know, start very simple and start adding things in, whether it's that particular shoot or just as you get more experienced and you kind of know how to work around problems and issues and things like that.
So deep, so complicated.
You would think it should be so simple just for food.
No, I know. I know it's not. I know for me, there's a certain amount of randomness. I don't have full control. I'm not a professional. And that's why, again, I appreciate the tips. Because for me, it's a matter of getting the plate on the table or on my little side table that I use for taking pictures, the one near the window, and shoot from different angles. I start spinning the plate around to get it from all different sides. And I want to do that really quickly, also because I do plan on eating that food. So
true. You don't want it to get cold.
Exactly. So I normally have my camera on a tripod, so at least I don't have that problem. And I know the angle is, it's what it is. That's the thing. So I do my best guess as to what's going to be using an empty plate as a prop. With my hand in it, usually, to get an idea. And then, you know, I just spin the thing around as quickly as I can, and I take 100 shots, or maybe more close to 50, because, again, I want to eat it. But still, there's a lot of shots. And then I just hope that one of them will work, which, you know, again, doesn't make me very professional, because you couldn't do that in a professional setting where, you know, wait a minute, I have
to... Well, and in that setup, you're not eating, you know, it's amazing the food, going back to the food styling too, the little tricks that they use. I mean, you know, they'll brush motor oil if they have to on the food. So obviously you're not going to eat it. Unless you're crazy. you know, and different things like that, you know, a lot of times, you know, steaks won't be cooked all the way or things will just be seared, or it won't be actually a whole plate of pasta. They'll have, you know, something inedible under it, and then the pasta just sits over it. So you get that beautiful piled up shape, but it's very controllable. And then they get tweezers and little butane torches and, you know, steamers. And it's amazing the things that I mean, a food stylist, like I said, is it's like a makeup artist. You know, your food is your model. You have the stylist who makes the food look its best and look beautiful. And then you have the photographer who captures that, you know, model. And then sometimes you have to be both things. Sometimes you are, you know, especially for small restaurants, you know, I've always kind of been the food stylist for it as well. And you kind of learn to work with the chefs. Because for restaurants too, you want, whether they're using it on their website or in an ad, you want the person looking at that food, that's what they're going to see when they come sit at the table. You don't want it, you know, we're not McDonald's here. Everybody knows that when you see a beautiful burger in a commercial for McDonald's, that's not what the burger is going to look like when you go to McDonald's. We all know that.
It's true.
I mean, I don't go there, but yeah, no.
You mentioned steamers. That makes a lot of sense. I wonder how can they get your pasta dish to be steaming while they're doing a photo shoot? Obviously, it's going to get cold. It's only
actually, you know what you can use?
Microsecond.
Because they'll use steamers, like those little handheld steamers to melt cheese for on burgers.
I see.
But if you want steam coming out of something, but you don't want to have, you know, you're not going to throw it in the microwave and make it super hot every 5 seconds.
Yeah.
So what they'll do is they'll wet cotton balls, they'll soak them in water, and then microwave those, and then hide it in the food, and then the steam comes off the cotton ball.
I wanted to end our interview or chat, let's say chat, with your considerations about Italian food, since you're 50% Italian and you know Italy firsthand, not only from your father, who was a chef, by the way, also from being in Italy many times. What do you think it's happening in North America with Italian food? Is there something, I do think there's something wrong going on, and what is your take there?
I think it's a couple different things, you know. I think it's like any cuisine, particularly because, you know, again, when Italians first emigrated here, it was, I think, two issues. They either couldn't find the particular ingredients that they used to be able to find at home, so they had to improvise, and then that just kind of stuck. Or they had maybe some influences from, you know, other cultures that were, you know, in, even though most of the neighborhoods early on were more isolated. So I think that's less of a factor, but it almost became a little bit of a fusion. And then, of course, you know, you get creative and you do your own thing and make up your own traditions. But I think it's like a lot of ethnic cuisines or region specific cuisines where it kind of gets, I hate to say dumbed down, but there's such a narrow expectation of what Italian food is. And I'm sure the same applies to Mexican food or Japanese food. I mean, pick any cuisine that people don't often go to the actual place and experience what it's really like. So you have that, you know, we had a restaurant for a little while and people would come in and ask for Caesar salad or the one that broke my heart the most, and I had a very hard time biting my tongue. Somebody goes, "This isn't how they make it at Olive Garden," and I almost died. I'm like, good. I mean, honestly, Olive Garden, I don't even count as Italian-American food. That's a whole other podcast. But you get sort of, you know, that oversimplified, people come to expect spaghetti and meatballs, you know, what they consider fettuccine Alfredo, lasagna, you know, just sort of this very narrow spectrum of what probably started out as authentic Italian food, you know, authentic Italian being from Italy and traditional to Italy. And then again, it just made its own changes over the generations for a variety of reasons. And that's just what people are used to.
And that's okay.
So I think that's part of the problem.
I think I know what's going on, of course. And I understand that Italian-American cuisine has all rights to be. What's happening is that also gets mixed up with what I call continental Italian, which is what you experience when you find a restaurant from a restaurateur who just came from Italy, or when you actually visit the country. Obviously, you're going to experience something completely different. One of the points that I make with my blog is to explain the difference between the two and learn how to recognize them. You know, you can get good food and bad food in either one. But the worst thing that can happen is for you to have the wrong expectations. And like it happened to your dad's restaurant, people come and ask you for a very specific things that they know from Olive Garden. And that's definitely not what your dad makes. But no. Those customers will be disappointed that you don't, because they really believe that that's Italian and that's what they expect. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, education and, you know,
absolutely,
communication is what we should continue to do. And I would like the same for other type of cuisine. I'd like to know,
of course,
am I visiting one of the many cliche standard Japanese restaurants in Vancouver, which is, you know, there are lots of, which mm-hmm. I love, but I know they're not very authentic. I have a suspicion that California roll is not a Japanese thing.
I'm going to say probably not.
But I like them, and it's okay. Mm-hmm. And I would like to know, when I'm actually stepping into a traditional mm-hmm. Japanese restaurant, that I'm going to experience something else. I'm going
absolutely.
To maybe do some research. It's not mm-hmm. my casual, you know, spontaneous meal. It's more like something that I want to do, and I'm ready mm-hmm. to eat something that maybe I won't like, but I want to experience it. So mm-hmm. that's the difference. I would like somehow things to be clear which one is
yeah.
which. You can do that through reviews and sites
it's
like that.
It's true, but I think it's also, you know, and obviously you're going to trust somebody where the chef or the owner is from there, because mm-hmm. you figure, well, that's better odds. But I think the other thing too, going back to the Italian food, is, you know, what part of what makes Italian food so fantastic, no matter what region it's from or what particular dish it is the simplicity typically, and the quality of the ingredient. I think you lose that a lot. People using dried herbs instead of fresh herbs. They're using garlic powder instead of real garlic,
mm-hmm.
and you know, cheap
shortcuts.
Tomatoes
shortcuts.
And so on and so forth, and they're also yeah. adding too many things. And I've had so many people, oh well, let me tell you how to make tomato sauce, or as they call it up north in the northeast, in the northeast of the US, gravy. And you know, and there's sugar and oregano yeah. and like all these crazy things that they start talking about it, and I'm like, ugh. I mean, sugar in the sauce, that's bleh. I've never put sugar in my sauce.
Well, sometimes
neither does my dad.
Right. Sometimes it's because you start with tomatoes that are not sweet at all, don't have any flavor.
Exactly. And that goes back to the quality.
Yeah, so compensation. Sometimes it comes from, you know, why not? Mm-hmm. The more, the better.
I guess.
But it's definitely something that I don't recommend. There's so many combinations that are delicious. Stick to one of those. And I do continue to say, traditional food is there for a reason. It's traditional because it works. Mm-hmm. It's just something that somehow was picked as a successful combination of flavors.
Mm-hmm.
Like carbonara, it's the idea of bacon and eggs. It's mm-hmm. obviously in another format, but it's something that works together. Mm-hmm. And there's really no point in trying to change that very much.
Well, and I, you know, the thing for me too is I don't have a problem with somebody, you know, whether it's a chef or just a person in their own kitchen. Obviously, you know, you're making it, you eat it, you can do whatever you want.
Sure.
You know, if you're happy, you're not wrong necessarily. However, mm-hmm. You know, I think that innovation and experimentation is great. I'm not saying that, you know, for me, it's not a matter of, oh, you can never change anything because it's the classic and that's just wrong.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's how it's presented. You know, when right. something that is very clearly not truly authentic Italian is presented as such, that's where the confusion happens, and that's where the communication needs, you know, say inspired by mm-hmm. authentic Italian, or this is our take on it, our twist on it, we've, you know, modernized it, which, you know, even in Italy there are restaurants that you see doing that, and that's fantastic, because then mm-hmm. there will be new classics potentially.
Yeah.
But carbonara does not have peas or cream or mushrooms, so please stop.
Raffaella, thanks so much. Thanks so much for your time. I realized
absolutely.
That we've been talking for quite some time. This is one of the longest podcasts I've ever recorded. I may have to split it in half. No, I will keep it intact. And yeah, we have to continue to talk about Italian food and about photography. It was great talking with you. I'll let you go on with your day. Talk later. Bye-bye.
Bye.